So today we'll talk a little bit about what Project Sunrise is and how we're putting that together. We'll also hear from our long-haul EA negotiating team, and they'll provide an update, and then hopefully plenty of time at the end for questions and answers. So in the room today, we've got Andrew David, our domestic CEO, and Andrew's also at the AOC Accountable Manager. Tino Vespina, International CEO, is an apology today. He's out on duty travel, but in his place, we have Naren Kumar, and I can't think of anyone better as Naren's roles. He's Executive Manager, Commercial, Network, Revenue Management, and also Aircraft Programs, of which Sunrise fits very nicely. We have Courtney Weinbergen from FlightOps, our FlightOps Comms Manager, Doug Alley, our FRMS Manager's in the room, and then the long-haul negotiating team with Nathan Safe, Richard Grady, Brad Gilchrist, and Andrew Kuhl. So Sunrise, what is it? Basically, it's just a project, well, not just, it's a project evaluating the purchase of growth long-range aircraft for the business. It is an incredibly important project, and I'll talk about that in a second, but it's a great opportunity for Qantas International because for the first time in well over 10 years, we're talking about growing the business. And we do need to be really clear here. These are all growth aircraft. They are not replacement aircraft. And, of course, in pilot world, that will mean lots of jobs and promotions. We know that the international is a very tough business. And while other Qantas business segments, through a lot of hard work by all of us over many, many years now, has become more stable through the cycles, Qantas International is still quite volatile. And I guess it's not surprising when you just think of the competitive landscape in terms of the number of competitors, and we know it's not an even or level playing field out there. The international business is disproportionately affected by fuel and foreign exchange changes and movements, and also just general shocks, be it geopolitical or weather-related or whatever. And it all makes for a tough business, but the good thing about Project Sunrise is we believe that this long-range point-to-point flying can give us a real strategic advantage that's not easily replicated by other carriers and our competitors. So strategically, it's the right thing to do, but of course, and as we've been saying for a long time, it has its challenges. Just before I hand over to Naren to give us a bit more in-depth around the project, just a quick update on where we are with our existing fleets. None of this should be new to you, but the A380s have now just started going through their reconfiguration program up in Dresden in Germany, and also started the C-12 heavy maintenance checks in Abu Dhabi. So in rough terms, those aircraft are sort of half-life now, so another good 10 years or so left in our 12 A380s. 747s, as we know, are retiring in the next year or so. For our A330 fleet, nothing planned at this stage, but any future replacements isn't part of the Sunrise project. And with our 787s, we currently have 9 hulls and we have 14 firm orders. So we're on our way to 14. And I guess if you think about Project Sunrise and flight operations, or the lens we look through it, there's two main lenses, or three really, I guess. Part of it is just the T's and C's and what an EA would look like there, and that's currently being negotiated. We have to look at it through our FRMS lens. So these flights, depending on the day and the time of year, 1.5 to 2 hours longer than some of our existing ultra-long-haul flights, so we need to fully understand that impact and make sure we're working through it to make those flights will comply with our safety management system, which of course our FRMS is part of. And then there's a whole lot of work we're doing also around the technical specs of the aircraft and airspace management. So on that note, I'll hand over to Naren. He's asking to give us an update on the project.
Thanks, Dick, and thanks for the opportunity to come and provide an update in terms of how we are travelling in terms of the business case and some of the points. I guess I want to reiterate some of the points that Dick has already alluded to, that this, study, business case that we are developing is a strategic opportunity. We have long said that, you know, our tyranny of distance, the ability to not be able to fly point to point and compete against the hub carriers. We now have the manufacturers, both Boeing and Airbus, offering us the technology that can enable us to have the ultra long range flying nonstop from the East Coast to New York as well as to London. And in doing that, the advantage, I guess, one of the things that we're also doing from an internal business perspective, not only for Qantas International, but for the group, but across our workforce, including the pilot community, is that this is not a substitute aircraft. This is growth aircraft. The business case is being developed on the premise of 12 additional aircraft joining the fleet, in addition to the 12 A380s, which will remain in our fleet. As many of you may be aware, we've started the reconfiguration, and that will be completed towards the back end of next year. All 14 789s will be in our fleet, as well as the continued operations of the A330 that we have in our, that we've also done the reconfiguration with. And so when we talk about our 12 aircraft for Sunrise, it is 12 growth aircraft that will fly a network that provides additional capacity, additional, you know, sort of sectors, additional seats. However, because it is growth, it means that the invested capital that we have to inject in the business is going to be more than double what we currently have invested in Qantas International. And that is the reason why there has been a enormous amount of, I guess, scrutiny that is being put on the business case. The robustness of the business case has been continued to be tested, and we are wanting to make sure that, accepting that this is not going to be without risk, that we, if we were to proceed with a business case, we have a sound basis on a most, you know, sort of a best informed view that this is going to be a sustainable, economically viable investment that can, you know, sort of provide the return on the investment we're going to make to our shareholders. Clearly, they are looking at this very closely and clearly as well. Because if we are going to spend the billions of dollars in this growth vehicle, there's a clear expectation by investors that they get a return on that investment as well. So our focus has been both, you know, sort of not only in terms of the strategic opportunity, but, you know, looking at it operationally, looking at it commercially, looking at it from a financial lens, and looking at it from a business lens as to see how we can actually have a sustainable case that can meet the required return. Towards that end, we have also been very, very transparent with, you know, sort of members of the APA executive in terms of how we have gone about building the business case, the assumptions we have actually put in developing the business case, and the status of the business case in terms of where we are. And that conversation started back in August this year, and we have been as transparent as we can be in terms of the, you know, sort of the workings of the business case as well. Tino would have loved to have been here today, but he is not here because he is indeed talking to the manufacturers. In the information that we have shared thus far, we have made it clear that we are not where we need to be to meet the hurdle rate. And to close the gap, we are continuing to look at all potential levers, including going back to the manufacturers, and that is where he is at the moment in trying to see what can be secure. Concurrently, we have also looked at, an external review of the inputs that have gone into the business case, the robustness of the business case. And at this time, the task that is in hand for myself to build for our internal group management committee and then take to the December board is subject to us being able to achieve the required improvements that we have sought from the pilot group, as well as the remainder of the gap being closed, that we would be, we believe we have, we are tracking towards being able to go to the December board with a decision. So that is what Alan has said publicly, that we are going to work to a December timeline, and that's what we are working to at this point in time. But all of it is predicated that us being able to meet, the required hurdle rates as we go forward in the next 4 to 6 week period as well. So I'll be more than happy to take any questions at the end as well to further elaborate on, but maybe I'll hand back to yourself, Dick, for the next part of the update.
Okay, thanks, Noreen. I might hand over to Nathan now to give us an update on where we are with bargaining.
Thanks, Dick. So as Noreen mentioned in his outline of the business case just there, the business case currently is left with a small gap to the ROIC target. Flight operations has been assigned, for want of a better term, the task of meeting some of that outstanding gap to the ROIC target. And our negotiations with APA to date have been focused around closing that gap. Those of you who read Dick's email about a week ago would have seen the kind of things that we have suggested to APA for us to be able to close the flight ops gap that forms part of the business case. And broadly speaking, they fall into three main buckets. The first is multivariant flying. The second is around some of our training costs. And the third is around capping the pay scales of new hire second officers. So that would be pilots who join the company after this EBA is approved by Fair Work. It would not apply to any pilots who are currently working under the long haul or indeed the short haul EBA. So if I could touch on those three buckets in a little more detail. Everyone listening in, I'm sure, is aware that both major manufacturers these days offer short cross qualification courses such that pilots can do flying on two particular types at once. There's other airlines around the world who are doing this at the moment, including Cathay Pacific and Finnair, among others. And what we're looking at here for Sunrise, given that we're looking at a 777X or an A350-1000, is multivariant flying between the A330 and the A350, if the 350 is the winner of the Project Sunrise process, or between the 777X and the 787, if Boeing is the winner. James Boland and his team have designed some very efficient training paths in order for our pilots on those fleets to be able to be qualified to fly both types at once. Generally, they involve something between 2 to 4 simulators and 2 to 4 line sectors to become multivariant qualified. And we're trying to work with APA to find ways of leveraging the benefits of multivariant qualified pilots to achieve a large component of the flight ops savings that flight operations has been asked to provide. So the savings in multivariant flying, of course, come from things like reduced standby coverage, operational disruption coverage, and so on. The way we see that working varies a little bit between whether it's an Airbus scenario or a Boeing scenario. In the Airbus scenario, we have discussed with APA limiting the multivariant qualification to opt-in pilots only. So no existing A330 pilot would be compelled against their will to become a Sunrise qualified pilot. It would be on an opt-in basis, and probably only in the bases where Sunrise flying is concentrated. So if you look at the proposed Sunrise network or destinations and routes we've talked about, Sydney would of course be the most obvious place where we would seek multivariant qualified pilots, at least to begin with. We think multivariant flying is actually a fantastic way of addressing some of the fatigue concerns that a lot of pilots have. A lot of the modelling we've done shows that if you did a 50-50 mix in the Airbus scenario of Sunrise flying and just A330 flying, you'd in fact be avoiding a lot of repetition of the Sunrise sectors. So we're not proposing that pilots on the Sunrise type would be going non-stop back to London and New York over and over again. We're proposing that trips like that would actually be only once or twice a bid period, of course, depending on people's exact rosters, but that you would have non-Sunrise flying making up at least half of your roster as well in order to mitigate those concerns around doing heavily or exclusively Sunrise flying. In terms of how we would facilitate in the EBA, we've been into quite detailed discussions with APA on that. The Sunrise business case has been modelled on achieving a pilot cost base that is the same as the 787 or equivalent to the 787 in the Airbus scenario across the planned Sunrise network, given, of course, we have A330 pay rates already in the EBA and we're seeking to do multivariant flying between the 330 and the 350. We have discussed with APA whether we would continue to use A330 hourly rates for Sunrise flying but have a modified overtime start point on some of the longer tours of duty, such as pilots doing that kind of flying, the Sydney-New York sectors or Sydney-London sectors, were receiving additional monetary compensation over and above just the A330 hourly rate on those longer sectors. I won't go into too much more detail on that because, of course, it's subject to ongoing negotiations, but that is one sort of structure that we're looking at. In the training space, training is a very expensive part of what we do. You saw from Dick's email that we've had nearly 2,000 training courses across the entire mainline business since FY16, so many of us have had the opportunity for pay rises and promotions and a change of scenery. We'd like to see that continue at maximum rate with Sunrise coming in, but of course that does come at a cost. The training costs for introducing Sunrise aircraft alone we expect would be well over $100 million in the introduction phase. And to that end, we are also discussing with APA and other bargaining reps some ways of reducing our training costs. One of those ways is in looking at the ability to pre-allocate training such that it goes on your line before the rosters are built and published, similar to what is done in short haul now. But we have, of course said to APA and other bargaining representatives that we are happy to entertain a system whereby that pre-allocation of training is informed by pilots bidding or pilots expressing a preference for the dates that their training would be on. It's also a key component of our move towards evidence-based training, which I know you've seen a little bit about recently. The timeline to move to EBT is about a year from now, so we'd like to have the EBA facilitate that. We think that evidence-based training will be a preferred methodology for pilots undergoing training on consecutive back-to-back days. We think the training experience overall will be much more positive as part of EBT. We've got a couple of other smaller training-related claims in there as well about moving away from a minimum personal flying annual sector count for training pilots for our CATs and our TCs, and instead using a percentage of divisor to construct their personal flying quantums. The third big bucket in terms of where we're trying to find these savings to meet the Sunrise business case comes from the capping of the new hire second officer's pay. As we all know, at the moment, existing pilots move up the year 1 to 12 scales on the 380, 330 and 74, and on the 787, they move up the year scales 1 to 4. What we're proposing is that new hires post-EBA approving this EBA would be capped at a lower level than the current year 12 or year 4 level in order to provide the business with the savings required to help meet the flight ops business case target. That, of course, would not apply to any of you listening in or anyone covered by either of our EBAs at the moment. So when you've heard things perhaps in the media or elsewhere that Qantas is requiring a 30% productivity gain for this EBA, that's not true. What we are asking for is essentially those three things. We've deliberately gone looking in areas that don't affect your take-home pay. We aren't targeting hourly rates or MDC or anything like that. We've tried to find all the savings that we can from those three particular areas. And Dick, do you want any more detail on that?
No, I think that's a good place to leave it. Maybe now open it up to some questions. So just as a reminder, if you have any questions, and I know we did receive some earlier. Yes, so to email pilotea, one word or lowercase, pilotea@qantas.com.au, pilotea@qantas.com.au. Now, I know we did receive some earlier questions.
Do you want to read them out?
Yeah.
Okay. So first question, Dick, says the pilots at the greatest fatigue and welfare risk will be those with the least control of their roster. That's currently the junior pilots. Is the company considering a rotating bidding priority system to ensure that the workload of Sunrise Flying is equally spread across the pilot workforce?
Yeah, I'll have a crack at that one. So our going-in assumption for Sunrise is 787 T's and C's, and that does have a rotating seniority system. I think also over the last relatively short period of time, we know our work on FRMS has been growing, increasing a lot, and we the more we look into how to best manage fatigue, and it's not only for ultra long haul four pilot operations, but three pilot operations and two pilot operations, which all have their own challenges, where we believe and are confident as our system matures, people get comfortable and trust in it, that the tours of duty and rostering will be guided very much by our safety management system focusing on fatigue. So I think we're long past the days, and certainly heading in the wrong direction of being at the bottom of the ladder. This just means getting undesirable flying from a fatigue point of view.
Yeah, and just to finish off what Dick said, we also see that the use of multi-variant flying is providing a lot of variety to pilots who are Sunrise qualified. We aren't proposing that pilots will exclusively do Sunrise flying. That's why we've pursued this multi-variant idea. If you are an Airbus multi-variant qualified pilot, you will do some Sunrise flying, but then you also do a bunch of what is now considered regular A330 flying. Similarly, if it's a Boeing type that's picked, you'll do some Boeing Sunrise flying in the 777, but then you would also have the opportunity as part of that fleet's already existing PSN to also mix that up with some shorter range flying as well. Next question might be good for one for Naren. Can we see an example forecast of potential flying, including Sunrise destinations?
In terms of route network, I assume. So, look, the business case has been built looking at a potential network. Obviously, when we talk about a 20-year horizon, we have to take into account some assumptions. I feel the assumptions we have used from a network perspective, from a configuration perspective, from a sort of type of likely schedule that we'll deploy, and also the in terms of the premium mix, in terms of the number of seats we're going to have on the aircraft that we are modeling, informs us that the ultra long haul flying requires more premium seats. Today we have circa 30% of our seats in premium configuration. When the A380 actually comes out of reconfiguration, it'll go from 23% to 30%. Our 787s currently have 30% premium seats. The Sunrise aircraft will have higher than 30%, be closer to 40% is what we're modeling on. And that takes into account that people are more, I guess, likely to pay a premium for, more likely to use a premium seat for the ultra long haul flying. We do require a premium in terms of the revenue that we obtain. And therefore, the mix is oriented towards more premium seats and less economy seats. In terms of the network, clearly what we are sort of informed by is a strong, rich history of where our core markets are. And clearly, North America and our London operations and the success that we have had on the Perth-London informs us about the willingness of corporates, we believe, to fly nonstop from Australia to London and to New York. New York is a little bit easier in terms of forming a view on because we do carry people to New York via Los Angeles from Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, and therefore that, I guess, is the easier of the two. When it comes to Sydney, London, for example, we've got to remember we're talking again in the context of what I mentioned, which is growth. So that flying, if we were to look at a Sydney-London, is in addition to Sydney-Singapore-London with an A380 and the continuation of a Perth-London. So we're talking about a third frequency into London. So again, a flavor of the growth. The other markets that we're looking at is basically how we actually get the maximum utilization, having regard to things such as curfew, having regard to slots, and having, sort of how we can actually utilize the total fleet, not only of Sunrise aircraft, but also the A380 and the 787 that have demonstrated capability as well. So, you know, clearly as we go forward, we'll be looking at, you know, if we were to go with this, you know, no secret on London and New York, but we will be looking at other destinations that we will be also wanting to add as part of the growth with the total international fleet.
Thanks, Naren. Another question that just came in has been asked a couple of times in a couple of different ways is around the five-year training freeze that we proposed. The question seems to be related as to whom it will apply. We're not seeking to apply that to new join second officers. So a new hire who's joining after their CBA is approved or who's joined in the last 5 years, they wouldn't be subject to the five-year freeze. It's only after people have chosen to change types that we would seek to increase the already existing freeze periods, which are currently in the EBA at either 18 months for initial command or two training blocks for other type changes, where we'd be seeking to extend those to 5 years. There's a question, Dick, about crew complement. It says, Dick, what is the company's proposed crew complement for these long sector flight times, i.e. two captains, two FOs, or even five crew?
Maybe I'll start, and Doug might want to weigh in as well. So, so let me start. We're open to changing if that's what the data and the science and the feedback tells us. We've built a safety case based on a bow tie risk model. No, a lot of you won't be familiar with that model, but it's a very in-depth way of looking at a tyre operation. So where we've built a safety case or on the way that the methodology, we look at the future city pairs and we look at all things fatigue. So that's from when you the schedule, so the time of sign-on, the length of sector, the sleep opportunity, time of wakefulness, and crew complement will also be in that mix. We're expecting very soon to have a very rich data set back from our Perth, London, Melbourne LAC study, and maybe Doug can touch on that in a minute. Plus, we're getting more valuable data from our three research flights, the two times New York, Sydney, and London, Sydney, which launches this week. Doug, anything you'd like to add there?
Not only that. As Dick has mentioned, we have gone through a significant piece of work with the Bowtie risk assessment. It identifies up to 500 controls. It's probably the biggest risk assessment Qantas has, or that is the biggest risk assessment that Qantas has ever completed. That will form part of the safety case if Project Sunrise is to proceed. The other pieces of work, as Dick has mentioned, are the 787 fatigue study. That has the data collection has finished for that, and we're just waiting for Alertness CRC and Monash University to provide the final report for that. One thing I will confirm is that once those results are handed to Qantas, they will be made available. It's a report that we see being able to communicate to everyone. We won't hold that back, but that will also form part of the safety discussion around Sunrise. It is a study, a very scientific study on using our current crew complement and composition. So we feel that we've got, a 12-month data collection study on current crew composition on long-range flying. The research flights are just a fantastic opportunity to collect probably the most in-depth scientific data available to us to really inform 20-plus hour tours of duty. So we've got the three flights that are scheduled so far. The second one comes out of London this week. Again, a report will be submitted from Monash University on the data collected on those flights. We've worked with Boeing and Airbus in pulling that piece of research together. So again, it's a very in-depth piece of study. We have, again, used our current crew composition and gathered data on that, and we're using 787 line crew to do that so that the data is as real as possible. So I guess there are multiple streams of work that are being done under our FRMS in order to inform these operations, which will all come together later this year.
But there's a question, are night credits in the mix Sorry, are night credits in the mix night credits for negotiation? If so, why? I'll take that. So we're not proposing on the Sunrise type anything different than what is done on the 787. So the 787, as everyone knows, there are no four pilot night credits on the 78, and that's what we're proposing for the Sunrise flying, whether it's on the 777 or on the A350. We are not proposing to touch three pilot night credits on either the A330 or the 787. I think you may have read somewhere, some of you, that we were seeking to reduce or take away three pilot night credits on the 787. That was discussed in bargaining very early on, but that is no longer being discussed and is not being pursued by Qantas. There's another question. Is the second officer pay scale capping a requirement to go ahead, or is it just a possibility? It's not a requirement. The requirement for us is to meet the flight operations gap to the overall business case ROIC target. And that was simply one way that we proposed to APA and other bargaining reps that we get there. If we didn't pursue that, then the savings would quite naturally have to come from current pilots, including everyone listening and everyone, to be frank, everyone voting on the EBA. So we put forward this as an alternative way of meeting a very large part of the target that flight operations needs to meet for Sunrise to go ahead. Maybe one for you, Naren. What would be the proposed delivery schedule of the Sunrise aircraft based on the research to date, e.g. which year would aircraft 12 arrive?
Yes, and so the delivery profile obviously is going to be determined by the decision. So working off the back of conversations that we've been having with both the manufacturers it could be as early as 2023. This is calendar year 23, and it goes out to, and we wouldn't get, if we were to go for all 12 aircraft, which is what we are working on, in terms of the training and entry into service, the logistics of making it happen, our planning assumptions are working off that being on approximately 2.5-3 year basis. So from the point we start, it'll be 3 years. For entry into service of the 12th aircraft. The delivery profiles for Airbus aircraft is different to the Boeing aircraft, and we are working with both the manufacturers in terms of if we were to work towards a December decision and a outcome with the pilots by February as a confirmation, what delivery. So those conversations are actually where Tino is also having that conversation as we speak, but a three-year delivery profile from the first aircraft and the last aircraft.
Thanks, Naren. We've had a couple of questions along these lines, so I'll answer this one. It's are these concessions being sought only for Project Sunrise, i.e. what happens if the concessions are all agreed to by pilots and the company does not go ahead? Absolutely a fair point, and we've made clear to APA and others that we're bargaining with that the concessions we're seeking would only go ahead if Project Sunrise goes ahead and if the aircraft are ordered. We don't reasonably expect that people would commit to providing these savings if Project Sunrise didn't go ahead. So we've told everyone that we're bargaining with that we are happy for the EBA to make crystal clear that any concessions that go towards the ROIC target are only activated if Project Sunrise proceeds. Dick, I don't know if you want to have a go at this one, but there's been a few general questions along the lines of the size of the aircraft being bigger than the 787.
I can talk about it in the context of the configuration of the aircraft, is how we have viewed this. The seat, layout that we've worked to has gone through multiple iterations, if I could call it that, close to a 100 LOPAs that we have worked on to say how can we optimize and maximize the revenue as well as the performance capability of the aircraft. And the current configuration that we're working on, and we do not see any significant or material change from that, is that in terms of the number of packs on board will be equivalent to what we have on the 789, whether it's the 777 or the A350. So both those aircraft are very similar in terms of configuration. But as I mentioned earlier, we are looking at a slightly higher premium mix as well to make sure the performance capability of the aircraft is optimized as well.
Thanks, man. We see great opportunity here to align 787 and Sunrise aircraft, and I guess some of the questions have been relating to the old speed-weight ratio, which is, I guess, it was an historic thing. As we know, many airlines have moved away from that now to fleet pays or similar things. We know Emirates, for example, 380-777 is the same. British Airways have similar methodologies as well. So, look, certainly acknowledge historically it's the way we've gone. The bigger aircraft have come in, and it's attracted more pay. But equally, you know, we think back to the conversation we've had around how tough this business is, and we need to keep evolving. I think this is one of those things where we need to think differently. And actually, if I cast my mind back to when we were negotiating what ultimately was the 787, at the time we were talking, when the decision hadn't been made, it was a 78350, and it was pretty much in the same bucket. So there's a few different lenses there, but that's where we believe it should be.
I think it's important for everyone to understand that while the 350 may or may not weigh a little bit more, you know, max takeoff weight than the 789, whether it's just over 300 tonnes or whatever it ends up being, as Naren's alluded to, the total seat count is essentially going to be the same as the 787, which really determines the commercial nature of the business case. It's not really the size of the aircraft, it's how much revenue we can generate, and we couldn't fit 400 people into an A350 and fly it on these kind of routes, so that's important to remember. This might be one for you, Andrew. Are you able to discuss how other segments of the business are contributing to closing the gap required to go ahead with Project Sunrise?
Yeah, sure. So, look, the way to look at this is just to reflect on what's happened across the business, and let me just do it area by area. So engineering 9 years ago had 5,500 employees in our engineering division. Today it's 3,300. The nature of engineering on new aircraft has changed. We get a lot more data. We can do more predictive maintenance. The newer aircraft don't require the same level of maintenance. The older aircraft, all the heavy checks are being done offshore. So engineering is just a evolution of process that we've had underway now for 6-7 years. In cabin crew and ground ops, we have had multiple employee entities in place for some time now. The discussions we had with cabin crew were exactly the same as we had with Sunrise, so looking to do a similar deal like we did last time. So that's what's happening with cabin crew. With head office, the business case is predicated on no increase in head office costs. In fact, overall with head office, costs haven't changed since we made the call with the 5,000 redundancies back in 2014. That is monitored closely. And indeed, if you work in Mascot, transformation and restructuring is part of everyday business now and something that is happening constantly. The two areas of growth in the business in terms of new jobs are the tech area. So we are employing more people focused on how we digitalize our business. So data scientists, analysts, people like that, because that's the way everybody's going. And then the other area of growth is pilots. So pilots is one of two areas, crew in total, but specifically pilots, is one of two areas in the business where we are employing more people and we are growing. That's off the back of the 7-8s, and hopefully we can get a Sunrise deal done, and we will see another, how many new pilots in?
400
new pilots in, with all the subsequent training and promotion in rank and type that goes on. So that's how all the other areas are contributing. And I do come back to, there's really only two areas of growth in the business right now. And if you're in pilot in this business right now, you are in one of those growth areas.
This one might be for you, Naren or Andrew. We have been told that we have options on 787s at good prices. We have also been told in the past that we were looking at city pairs like Sydney, Vancouver and Perth, Paris. What is the status of the business case for this? Would this be a lower risk option?
Yeah, I think right at the outset, Dick mentioned about the volatility of the industry and how we continue to be exposed to, I guess, factors that are outside our control, and how we actually look at building resilience for the Qantas International business. And doing things like Perth, London, and what we're talking over here in Sunrise is not talking about necessarily increasing the dots on the map of the places that we want to fly to, but how do we actually build resilience with our core markets in North America and London. And so we are focusing, as I said, in terms of the sustainability of the international business, the returns, and getting some stability of the earnings through the cycle, and not having been exposed to and not being as exposed to some of the changes that have impacted us. Likewise, you know, in terms of new growth opportunities, clearly we'd only explore that if there was a case. The opportunities that we have in terms of options that we have for 787 aircraft is not one that we are saying if we don't invest in Sunrise that money will just go into another investment for growth elsewhere. However, inherent in the Sunrise network development are things like new services that we have modeled in terms of how we use the fleet, Sunrise aircraft and existing fleet, to markets, potential markets such as Paris or new points in North America as well. So we do that as part of the business case, and so clearly some of that is commercially sensitive, but the business case with 12 aircraft, all 12 aircraft are not going to be flying to New York and to London, right? And how we actually utilize the fleet gives the opportunity to fly to new destinations, including to markets such as Paris and potentially other markets in North America as well.
Thanks, Naren. We've had a couple of questions around the crew rest and toilet arrangements on proposed Sunrise aircraft. I want to go into that a little bit. I understand the LOPAs we're looking at on the Sunrise aircraft have two first-class toilets at the front of the aircraft for use by not very many first-class passengers. So a flight deck toilet per se we probably don't see as necessary, but...
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I think the information we've shared back, where we can share it is it's queuing for a toilet won't be a problem on these aircraft. As far as the crew rest facilities go, we've been to Seattle and Toulouse, or we've had a team there, and we took a couple of APA reps to view where the manufacturers were going with the crew rest. So the 787, I think, is fairly standard. Again, it's the two separate bunks, and there are two seats up inside the compartment. Airbus were looking at a whole new arrangement for us, and they're still working that through, is my understanding. Again, would have two bunks, two seats, but the Airbus one, from memory, is quite separated. Doug, if you've got any more insight into that?
No.
But it's been worked through, and the onboard rest facilities are an important part of your fatigue management system.
Okay. There's a question here around what happens if we don't reach agreement by December? Or the EBA is not voted up?
Well, I think we've been quite clear in terms of getting to a decision by December this year, one way or the other. The only thing that will be contingent on is making sure we meet the business hurdle rate by then, as well as the pilots achieving and delivering, and that'll be subject to ballot, is the thinking at the moment. That's how we have been conversing over here. All of this is going to be based on the board approving or not approving, But assuming we close the target, our view is that we'll take to the December board a recommendation, subject only to pilots, right? So,
yeah, and I think, look, Alan's been quite clear. He's been quoted publicly. This is a very exciting business case. It does give us the potential to put international in a very good place in terms of its sustainability. But we're not going to do it at all cost. Alan's been very clear. There's hurdle rates to hit. So if we can't hit those hurdle rates, we can't make the business case work. We can't get to an agreement on EBA. We will need to move on. We can only expect Airbus and Boeing to hold slots for so long. The business case, you've either got to make a decision you're going to make this work, or you've got to have the discipline to go, it's not going to work, you move on and you look at other options. So, and Alan's been very clear about that publicly.
Doug, this might be, you touched on FRMS a little bit before, but there's a question, what rest would be sufficient and what would be minimum required upline and then at home? So maybe you just want to touch on how the FRMS process will work and heat maps and other types of analysis you do.
Yeah, so as Dick sort of alluded to earlier, the FRMS process is designed to look after all of the areas of operation within our flying program. So it looks after short haul operation, the A330 and the sort of medium range flying, but then also the long range flying. And so when we look at new routes or new city pairs, as we will into the future with tours of duty greater than 18 hours, we do a lot of pre-modelling using our biomass model, a safety fast. And so we model different sort of departure times or rest scenarios based on the schedule that we're looking at. So that biomass model is it's got an algorithm within it that highlights areas of fatigue risk that then we would go away and look at if any were highlighted and sort of remodel all of those scenarios again to find a suitable modelling outcome. I guess that's why it's important as well, though, that we're out there collecting this data that we are at the moment through the 787 fatigue study, the research flights again, because it allows us to sort of validate or question what's coming out in the models and therefore inform the operation a little bit more. One point I'd make about the in-flight rest, it is, you know, with these research flights, we are one of the interesting things I think we'll be able to take out of those research flights is in-flight rest strategy and maybe potentially more guidance to crew around in-flight rest and strategy and how we would use those facilities under a Project Sunrise type operation. So the short, I wouldn't be able to give an exact sort of answer around what the rest periods would be, but needless to say, they would only be presented if the FRMS and importantly the FSAG believe that those rest periods were appropriate, and that's what we would move forward with. With Perth London, we started with a longer rest period in London for a number of reasons, but again, you would potentially mix around some rest periods just to see what worked best through your validation process, again, to validate the modelling that you produced prior to the operation being implemented.
Thanks, Doug. So while you're on a roll there, similar vein, where is CASA on tour of duties beyond the current limit of 20 hours?
Yeah, so as mentioned previously, we have presented the risk assessment, the bow tie risk assessment on tours of duty greater than 18 hours to CASA. And we've also presented a safety framework that we're proposing to use when going to them for approval for these tours of duty greater than 20 hours. We are still in discussion with them. CASA obviously have approved our FRMS trial back in February. They attend all of our FSAG meetings. They are part of the process. They will come through early in the new year and do an audit on our FRMS. And so they are working with us as we progress our safety case towards these tools of duty. But again, it's more of a putting a plan in place that if the project was approved, we would then go to CASA with a formal safety case for approval.
Thanks. Ren, I'm not sure how much detail you can go into on this one, but I'll see what you can say. We've been asked, what is the exact dollar value in regards to the gap in the ROIC mentioned earlier?
Yeah, so look, we have shared that in very openly and transparently with the members of the APACOM who have been NDA'd, and so we didn't hide that information from them as part of the in-depth assumptions, revenue assumptions, cost assumptions, network assumptions, utilization assumptions that we have actually built. And what the status of the internal rate of return we are at, and what we needed to achieve the business case hurdle. It's a larger number than the you know, sort of what we have sought from the pilot group, and so we are not saying that the pilot, you know, sort of benefits that we get from the pilot's business towards the business case closes the case. There is, you know, sort of a lot of work that we are continuing to do to make sure we arrive at the business case hurdle. So that has been very openly and transparently shared. I think it's confidential for us not to be able to put that on a forum such as this. But we have spoken to the APA executive members and also spoken to the APACOM members about the need for the target and the basis of the target.
Thanks. Just switching tracks a little bit, a couple of questions around staff travel. We've had one, which is why aren't we rewarded with confirmed long service leave seats? I think the simple answer to this one is that anything confirmed attracts enormous fringe benefit tax liability. I think we got some advice on this in the recent past, and a $2,000 airfare essentially ends up costing Qantas close to that amount in terms of fringe benefits tax. Unfortunately, anything that is not standby and is confirmed generates FBT liability for Qantas, which would be obviously extremely high in cost. We've had another question around what discussion is there around improved onload and upgrade for pilots with staff travel. I think at this stage, because we're still in negotiations, I'll just say that APA has put forward a number of staff travel claims. We are reviewing those as part of negotiations and discussing those internally, and any results of that you'll see in a deal is presented to pilots at the right time.
And Nathan, and I have two other points on staff travel. One, any confirmed seat is revenue lost, so a significant impact to the bottom line of the business. And secondly, there is upwards of 250,000 people, if you include all the retirees, who have, and families who have access to staff travel. Every time you touch staff travel, you make one group happy and another group unhappy. So it is a very, very complex system, process to manage.
We've had a question on a short-haul EVA. Although we're mainly here to talk about long-haul and Sunrise, I think Alex can perhaps provide a quick update on that. The question is, where does the short-haul EVA priority lie amongst all of this? It has been expired for longer.
Thanks, Nathan. So we had a meeting with APA last week after the short-haul EA survey results came back. We had a good discussion about what the pilot body had fed back to them in regards to the various areas that the pilots liked and or didn't like, and we're scheduled to meet again with them this Thursday. So it's very much a priority for us now that we have that survey information back, and we're looking to get that done as quickly as we can.
Thanks, Alex. For Naren or Andrew, we get this question a little bit in various forms, but the thrust of it is along the lines of, this question says, excited to hear more about the project and would love to see it go ahead. As a percentage of the overall cost to the Sunrise operation, what contribution will the pilot EA have? I think it's important to remember that really, you see things online and in various places about pilot costs only being a small percentage of the overall cost of running an airline, but I think it's important to remember that airlines are largely differentiated between the costs that they can control. The international business is a price-taking business that has dozens and dozens of competitors, between Australia and Europe, for example, where price takers generally on the price of fuel, although we can soften that with hedging and other you know, short-term initiatives, generally we're a price taker on most of the cost inputs. We're generally a price taker on the capital cost of acquiring the aircraft. So in terms of controllable costs, you know, pilot costs are not insignificant. They're not just a few percent. In terms of controllable costs, they make up much more than that.
Yep, and I wouldn't add any more than that, confirm that that's what how we look at it. It's the cost that we can actually control. And the pilot cost continues to be a growing percentage of the total controllable cost. And that is why, one of the reasons why we have said for, you know, sort of the benefits that this will deliver in terms of 400 additional jobs, the promotional training, and the opportunities that it delivers, that was formed the basis on why we are seeking the benefits that we are from the pilot group in this particular investment to counterbalance the risk that goes with that as well.
Okay, I think we're almost out of time, but there's another, just one last question here on, if the A350 is chosen, will the A330/350 dual endorsed pilots be flying under two different awards, and how would that work? So this is all subject to ongoing negotiation, but no, it wouldn't be under two different awards or two different agreements. It would all be under the same agreement. In the Airbus scenario, if the 350 is chosen, what we have been discussing in principle with APA to this point is using the pay tables for the A330, but applying an overtime rate for A350 flying. So if you did Sydney to London on the A350, you'd be on the A330 hourly rate, receiving an overtime payment from a certain point that is still being negotiated. So it wouldn't be under different EBAs or different awards, it would just have slightly different pay rules depending on sector length, is what we propose. I think we've covered most of the questions and themes. Is there anything else?
No, thanks, Nathan. So thanks everyone on the line. Thanks for your questions. Thanks to everyone in the room. Just to remind you, we have recorded, so we'll condense some of the conversation here and make sure we get it out to everybody. I also understand that some of the pilots, the system maxed out, so there's a new record for us, and we'll definitely be scheduling another webinar, so please just watch your emails or any of the other sites, and we'll get that advertised as soon as possible so we can get back together.
I might just answer one more that just came in at the buzzer. It says, does this agreement require voting on and approved by the pilots prior to December and going to the board? So the answer to that is no. What we are seeking from APA is agreement in principle or a heads of agreement on what the new EBA would contain by the December board. You would then have to go through a drafting process, which will take hopefully not more than about 4 or 5 weeks over the Christmas New Year period, and then the actual vote by the long-haul pilots on the EBA would occur in February, with a February vote outcome known prior to whatever Qantas board meeting occurs after that.
Okay, so thanks again, everyone. We'll get the next dates up as soon as possible, and thank you again for dialing in.